I want candy. Boop doop 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 doop. Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Yeah, very mild terrain this week for we're missing a member and also the film of choice. I am Richard Nicholas, hello. With me to do the podcast is Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
And Abigail Bain.
Hello.
Yeah, and the podcast is just us chatting about a film. Like a book club, but a podcast and not about books, about films. Simple as that. This week, we all looked at the film Candy from 1968 because it was my choice and I have terrible taste. And I will explain myself once Jamie has given the details of the film, because there is a 2006 film called Candy. It is not that one.
It is most definitely not that one. Okay. Candy is from 1968. It's directed by Christian Marquand, written by Buck Henry, based on a novel by, says here, Mason Hoffenberg, that is Terry Southern and Mason Hoffenberg. It has a plot summary here. But it seems irrelevant to, like,
surreal weirdness happens.
Yeah, it's young Candy is a high school girl who seeks truth and meaning in life, I guess, encountering a variety of kooky characters and, I'm going to put this in inverted commas, humorous sexual situations in the process.
I'd also put kooky in quotation marks as well.
And it has a very good cast. It's the first film of Ewa Orlin, who plays Candy Christian. It also has Marlon Brando, Richard Burton, James Coburn, John Huston, Walter Matthau, Ringo Starr, John Astin, who's like a classic, it's that guy actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then a slew of people doing all kinds of nonsense for 17 hours.
Yeah. Hmm. It is an all-star cast, which is all the more a shame that they're squandered.
Yeah, that's what suckers you in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what suckered me in the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and Abby, before I picked this for this particular podcast, me and Abby looked at it because Brando was in it, and we were watching All Things Brando.
Yeah.
And we were like, he plays some kind of Indian guru. This will either be the worst, most racist thing ever, or hilarious. It was the worst and most hilarious thing ever. Yeah, it was... But the reason I picked it this time was we haven't done a lot of psychedelic, surreal weirdness. We occasionally do. Occasionally. But nothing quite as 60s feeling. So this is a very 60s film. Maybe too 60s. Maybe a little bit too much of the psychedelia and the things that cause it. And, you know, but I wanted you guys to experience the confusion that me and Abby experienced the first time. And I wanted you to help share. We needed to discuss it because it does something to you as a film. And it's so weird. Oh, and also I had a dog called Candy. So it's her namesake. So that's another good reason, right? You should always watch films that your dog is called. Like... Jaws and
Godzilla.
Yes.
Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, all them dog names. No, but anyway, I just wanted you guys to share in my terror. And it's a weird dream, and it's one that I can show you guys. I didn't have the dream. The dream was someone else's, and they created it. But I wanted to share it with you what does this mean?
Sometimes this podcast, you know, depending on certain films that we've each seen, can serve as like therapy, as an opportunity to like purge after an awful experience.
Yeah, and this is very much that we're not celebrating a film I love. We're very much sitting ourselves down and sharing an experience. So that's why.
It's going to be a little bit like an AA meeting.
Yeah.
Abby. Before you watched it, the original time, what were you expecting from a film called Candy? Could have been about chocolate, could have been a lovely children's animation, or a sequel to Willy Wonka or something. What were you expecting from this film?
Well, the poster did give some clues that it was going to be about a pretty blonde woman who was probably an idiot. But that's about as far as it went.
Right.
I had no inkling that it was going to be quite so 60s as it was.
Yeah. I didn't know going into it that it is allegedly a adult film satire. I don't know what exactly it's satiring, other than it's like that, only the Rudy stuff from adult movies is not in it. And I'd say it's to its detriment, but there's nothing you could add or take away. Well, you could take away all of it. But I don't know. I don't think it's very satirical of that particular type of movie. I don't know why you would want to. It's trying to say something about the adult movie industry and how the, at least in the 50s and 60s, the narratives were strung together or something. But I don't know. I feel sorry. Jamie, what were you expecting before you'd seen the film?
I actually think my expectations were sort of met, because I thought this is going to be like a really like full on 60s psychedelic kind of nonsensical, but probably somewhat funny, and it took that fairly accurate expectation, and then it like flicked it out like one of those extendable batons and beat me over the head with it for like 2 hours.
Yeah, well, I thought it would appeal to you. You like sort of weirdness and surreal cinema.
I do, but
not like this.
And it like I actually said about halfway through its 9-hour running time that I remember saying, this is kind of like a really cheap porn film, but with all the actual sex removed. And then when I found out that it was allegedly supposed to be a satire of porn movies, that suddenly made sense.
Mm.
Yeah, but if by satire it means literally just doing one but cutting out, it doesn't so much satirize anything, but is a very bad film. All of those films would be, it's just if you took all the scenes that are like you don't have to censor out of adult movies and just strung them together, it wouldn't make a good film, and they've proven that with this film.
It's like a nightmare version of a Carry On film.
I want to try and move away from negativity a little, because another reason I kind of wanted to suggest it is there's a lot of things in it that are kind of, what is this? And this, certain bits can be clipped and are brilliant. Like Richard Burton is one of the first characters we get introduced to, and he is phenomenal. And I genuinely think he's one of the funnier bits of it, because his character is a funny concept and amusingly.
Yeah, because he's a really pretentious poet.
Yeah.
And I like when he appeared, he appears in a high school giving a reading of one of his awful poems. And at that point, because that's like really early on in the film, I was like, okay, I can maybe get on board with this. Because every time he's anywhere, doesn't matter where he is, there's always wind blowing back his scarf and his hair.
Yeah.
Genius. I thought that was great.
That was a nice touch. And at that point, I was like, this might be good. And then about 5 minutes later, I was like, no.
Well, I like it pretty much all the bit he's in. Because if you're not sure where the story's going, which is nowhere, but if you're like, okay, what is this? You establish that there's this schoolgirl woman thing. And
from space.
Yeah, they kind of pan in from outer space to the globe. And then some magical thing comes down, or part of the psychedelia is being weird visually, but it sort of implies that some kind of alien thing happens to a girl or this woman, or it puts her there, but then she's already she has a father and stuff. She isn't just land. She understands her life in high school enough. But anyway, she's imbued with this alien thingy-majig, and it's sort of enigmatic rather than weird. And then we get going with this young high school girl who's daydreaming in class, and then her dad is her teacher, and they sort of just move on to the bit with the poet turning up, don't they?
There's too much, but too. Yeah.
Already.
Yeah. I think we should probably just explain that she has a series of encounters with different people in different places.
Yeah.
And maybe pick out our favourites or our least favourites, depending on your mood.
Well, this is the thing. It's kind of like Alice in Wonderland, only instead of, you know, meeting Dodos and Mad March Hares, she meets lecherous men with different job titles that all try and, like, force themselves on her. So,
and what's interesting about the first section is it has the best thing, which is Richard Burton, and the worst thing, which is Ringo Starr.
Oh, Ringo. Wow. Manuel.
Yeah. Actually, before we mention them, Emmanuel. Who is the actor playing her dad and her uncle?
That's John Astin. That's the guy who's one of the perennial that guy actors.
Is he in Adam's Family?
He was in the 90s TV series as Gomez.
Yes, that's where I was like, you're from something. I thought it was Adam's Family. Yeah.
He's also been in a million different cartoons. Like, he was in Duckman, he was in Animaniacs.
He's just got a great voice, that's why, I guess.
He was in Erie, Indiana as well.
Yeah. And he's all right as the father-teacher figure. He's a bit weak and weird. But as the
uncle.
Yeah. Kind of funny. It's weird that he seems to enjoy being in the film when he's the uncle, which is kind of creepy, to be honest. But, like, he is quite funny when he switches to having a moustache and no glasses, which is how he plays his own brother. But I just wanted to mention him because he's at the start, and we'll go on to Ringo Starr because he is the most questionable part of this.
Oh.
By like, it's like stunt casting all the way through the film. But the most out of place is the drummer of the Beatles playing a Mexican gardener.
Yeah,
it makes Brando's Indian almost acceptable. That's how bad his Mexican was.
Yeah, great moments where he tries. Well, he attempts Mexican. And it sounds terrible, but then he also slips into Liverpudlian a little bit as well. And he doesn't even have that many lines, so he couldn't even sound authentic for a moment.
Oh.
It's incredible. One of the reasons I like this film a little bit is because of that. It's just Ringo Starr suddenly is in the film, peeping out of a bush going, "This is no good. This is very bad. It's just, what is happening? Why is there a beetle in a bush?" In real life, beetles in bushes are acceptable, but why is this one wearing a moustache and talking in a fake Mexican accent? Seriously, why, guys? Why did this happen?
I don't know. I can only imagine that this movie read well as a script.
It's based on a book, I think.
Yeah, it is, and the book is similar to, like, I after I finished this film, I just thought, I have to find out how this happened.
Maybe there's an explanation online.
Yeah, so I read about the book, and the book's a little, if I remember right, the book's a little bit darker and a bit more anarchic, and it's somewhat based on a Voltaire story. And that's as far as I got I had to have a lie down.
It depends, actually. I read something else that said that one guy who read the book said, "Oh, this is a take on Candida by Voltaire."
Yeah, there you
go. Then somebody else said, I think it was the writer said, "It isn't actually, but you know, if they decided it is, then fine."
Yeah, they were like, "Oh, yeah, it is actually kind of similar." That wasn't
So it's maybe attempting pretentious arthouse-ness occasionally, but it's very clearly indulging titillation. You know, it's very odd because it cuts out any time where it's going to get too racy for like a regular movie. It doesn't do that, and it's almost saying, "Car men, eh? Oh, what are they like? And we're not doing that. We're kind of feminist, even though it's totally not in any way."
Aren't men pervs? All right, take your clothes off. I'm going to film you running away from another man as I focus the camera at certain angles.
Yeah, it's odd.
I think that's the main thing about this movie that makes me have these two very different emotions about it at the same time. is that visually, this movie was done very well. They've tried to be creative and strange and do things in a different way, but then all of the content is abhorrent.
The music, yeah. The music is very good, I thought.
Yeah, yes. I did like the soundtrack.
Very 60s, very yeah. like very fresh and contemporary 60s music as
yeah,
well.
Full on, rock like, and 60s psychedelic.
Yeah. And it's very good, and it really stops really weird, unusual montage-y scenes, because basically each section where she basically meets a guy, a character with a job title who eventually turns the comedy, in quotation marks, to essentially forcing themselves, like lusting after Candy, who's our main character. Yeah. And it's odd, because I don't know whether to feel sorry for women or men, because the men are portrayed, men are generally portrayed very badly, but she is a victim of all these men, so you feel sorry for women as well, because yeah. you kind of go, oh, poor attractive women, they never get a break, they're always just being hounded. And it's like, well, what point are you making, Phil?
Yeah.
You feel sorry for everyone who lives in this universe.
Yeah. That's one of the things I was thinking as I was watching it, is I would hate to live in that reality.
If you can call it that.
Yeah. It just, the whole time I was watching it, something would happen every 5 to 10 minutes that just made me feel really just creepy for watching it.
The first point for me was we have Richard Burton being this quite amusing character who is doing a good job of being this hammy poet, pseudo celebrity promoting himself, and then he's in a limousine or something with Candy, and he's the first person to sort of turn the for some reason everyone is attracted to her and wants to cop off with her, and he's the first, and you don't know what, you know, you don't know that everyone else is going to as well, so it kind of makes sense
what he does, because he's sort of lecherous. He's being one of those rock and roll poets,
yeah.
One of those,
although the way he does it was, you know, immediately one of those scenes that made me go, because it, you know, my need, what have you done to my need,
that is both despicable and hilarious at the same time.
When we watched this the first time, me and Abby, we love this bit because he is just the brilliant Richard Burton voice of going, need does not wait, need just wants, need takes, need. And he's just, and then he's kind of they're on, like, we're looking up at the bottom of, like, we're kind of, there's a glass pane of glass that the actors are on.
Limousine.
Yeah, it's a glass bottom limousine that we're looking up through, and he's spilt scotch and it's pouring on the floor, and he's trying to, you know, he's trying to seduce Candy, but then he starts licking the scotch off the floor and she gets away because, I don't know, there's a limo driver that is, like, there's this, like, limo driver character who Richard Burton has fake stories about why they're best friends. I don't know. But he lets her out. Go on, sorry.
That was another fantastic moment where she goes, oh, I saw that movie as well, when he tells her the story of how he got his driver, and he says, oh, in that case, I found him here doing this.
Yeah, he basically gives the origin story of his friend, limo driver, and then she says it's the movie of the week, and he goes, oh, I'll just make up another story then. That's the explanation. And then, yeah, at this point, we kind of do have a good comedy character established. He's going a bit weird, and we're feeling sympathetic towards Candy, and we don't know where it's going, and it is satirical so far. Then you interject, unwisely, Ringo Starr as this bizarre, racist Mexican character. And the really turning point of the creepiness is they go down to the basement, they're supposed to dry off or something in Candy's house, and Richard Burton just seems to talk Ringo Starr, Mexican gardener, around, who's not really supposed to be in the house, and he's making a big deal of it. And then he basically gets him to be, like, he says, like, revolution or something. Yeah. And then suddenly, it's as if it turns a switch in Ringo Starr's character's mind. And he's like, I also fancy Candy now, and will make love to her on this pool table, while Richard Burton makes out with a mannequin that looks a little bit like Candy, if, you know, this were a horror film. Like,
and then its eyes open, and I thought, oh, okay, here we go.
What is happening?
This is now, it's all downhill from here.
But like we said, we're not going to go through every single bit. It's too weird to really string the narrative. They don't string the narrative together properly. Basically, all that happens is through montage and music, we get to a point where I think, like, Ringo Starr has some veiled, regular-looking women, Mexican
cartel
biker
family, yeah,
biker cartel Mexican veil-wearing women chasing down Candy and her family, and they establish her stepfather as well, and they just it escalates to like an airbase where they just the plot just goes, no, we're doing something else now. And that's when Walter Matthau turns up for his sketch come bit, isn't it? That's another
bit
that of
is kind
film.
Like, that is kind of how it's set up as well, that it's like it's a series of sketch type scenes with different based around different characters
taped together with dreams and montage.
And what happens, her dad gets like a brain injury and they have to help him.
Yeah, the kind of cartel biker ladies like clubbing with something they got.
Yeah,
because I don't even know why they're doing it. They're just with.
It's because in a bizarre role reversal, the women of was it Manuel?
Emmanuel, yeah.
Emmanuel's family are after her because she has taken Manuel's innocence.
Deflowered him.
Yeah.
Even though not really, that it doesn't really explain anything. It doesn't have the decency, but it is being surreal. But it's like, what is going on? You just can't understand it at all. Like, at least with something that's meant to be a bit weird, you kind of follow why. Well, actually, that's not true. That's the point of surrealness, I guess, is to baffle around you.
A lot of the time, depending on who's made the film and how good they are, there will be some kind of almost like dream logic to it, where there's like an underlying sense. Whereas this was just I don't even have the words. I was actually speechless when this finished. I just had to be quiet for a while.
But what I want to talk about is Walter Matthau turns up and you go, wow, Richard Burton, Walter Matthau, well, this film is something, isn't it? And then he's just got this bit where he's like a really right wing paratrooper leader. Where he's got like his men in the plane, they all Candy and her family at this point are being rescued and flown off in a plane by the military, who are there for manoeuvres or something. They don't care about it. We won't care about it, right? But what did you guys make of Walter Matthau and his character in this part?
He had promise,
yeah,
and then didn't.
Yeah, he was funny to begin with, and then he got all pervy over Candy, and it went in that direction again.
It's almost like the conceit of we're satirizing adult movies got in the way of what could have been an interesting, surreal comedy film. Like, it could have just been weird and been funny, and that would have been enough. And they started off, it was quite good. He was kind of amusing the way he was so... he was just suspicious of Albanians or something, and saw Mexicans and Albanians as being the same thing. And he was just spurting out loads of patriotic American jingoism, and he was kind of funny and weird. And he wasn't helping the father who was injured. And then it just turned on I'll do a favor for you, even though I could have just given him medical help straight away. I will delay it with my weird comedy. And then I'll suddenly want you to undress and I'll be weird. And like every male character, they'll get weird at some point. And then a switch is flicked. All the paratroopers dive out the plane and we move on. They basically land the plane off camera. I don't know if, like...
I like that his... Candy's like, I don't know. Well, I don't even know what she is, the other character.
She's auntie.
And she's like, oh, I'll fly the plane. All right then, okay.
And cut to this bit now, where we're in a sort of... like, so the next funny, weird bit... we won't bother talking about the transitions. Let's just tell you, every time you transition between major scenes, it happens a weird way that isn't... she'll just walk out and wander off, and she'll be in another bit. So, the theatre... the concept-wise, quite good idea. We got a surgeon who does surgery for an audience, but it's kind of... there's, like, music playing to suggest it's like a bullfight... and he's kind of a performer as well as a surgeon. And I don't know why we had to have surgery in it. That wasn't necessary.
This is also James Coburn as the doctor.
That's right.
Dr. Crankite.
I mean, what is he doing in this? It's all stunt casting. They paid too much for the actors, apparently. They cost a lot to get these guys. And then even though it made, that's what I read on Wiki, is they made money on, like, people buying the film, but they had to pay so much to get all these actors in to waste their time. But, can anyone explain this?
He needs brain surgery, I guess, because he got hit in the head and he's unconscious.
The father who got injured.
Yeah. So, is it the uncle who knows about this brain surgeon?
It doesn't matter. There's a brain surgeon. It's kind of like theatre and bullfighting. The music plays. It's got weird montages, and then we just kind of go. I guess we'll wander around the corridors of the hospital, being unfunny and weird some more.
There was one bit I liked just before the surgery, where the nurse puts his gloves on, and for whatever reason, they filmed it backwards.
Right.
So him putting his gloves on was him having them taken off, but played backwards, so they kind of suck up onto his hands.
Could have done with more weirdness that made sense. Like, just putting in odd ways of filming stuff would be interesting if they did it more consistently.
Yeah, there was that. I was like, oh, that's cool. I don't think I said that about anything else in the film.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, what do you make of this whole, like, surgery and hospital farce stuff?
Again, it's sort of... It's like they think of a really good set piece for each bit.
And then don't think it through.
And just can't be bothered to join things up properly.
Yeah, well, traditionally, it would have been... You know, actors doing it in the thing it's allegedly satiring. So that would be what holds the scenes together. I don't know. They had a whole like party going on, like celebrating the surgery, but it's just kind of like a raunchy party, and then like there's some killjoy turns up, and it's very
odd. Her dad's hooked up, like he's got a plug in the back of his head now. All right.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah, who cares? Whatever. And it sort of plays out, and you kind of go, "This is the doctor was one of the ones who took longest to get to the point where he was being inappropriate." And it was kind of presented as he was going to do a medical examination, and it didn't go exactly the same as all of the other ones because it was interrupted. And there was just a horrible nurse and things, and I don't know.
It's just little bizarre moments in the hospital where she'd find someone and they'd just say something weird.
It got
and
proper,
then she'd run off.
It got proper Salvador Dali surreal films with like just people shouting stuff and just anger and fear and stuff. And then it was just, I guess she's, I don't even know what happened, but what was the next big person to turn up who had a gimmick that didn't make sense?
Yeah, I think I blacked out at this point.
It didn't make sense, whatever happened.
And then I did actually try and make notes while I was watching this film about like the sequence that happened, but it does sort of put you into this stupor.
Yeah, I can imagine the notes just turn into just gibberish.
It's like, one of
those
films.
Work and no play makes me a dull girl.
It's one of those films, if you fall asleep, which is entirely likely, watching it, you could easily not know if you dreamt the film a bit. You could easily bridge gaps with dreams more efficiently than the filmmakers did.
But she then ends up in a city or something. She's running through the streets and she bumps into these guys who are like in the mob or something.
It's very brief. She tries to buy a Coke without having money, and then the mob are involved. that doesn't even go the same way. It's not like that isn't a big thing that gets brushed over because
the director
is it the director? Or is it I'm filmmaker? Sure that is,
yeah, I'm pretty sure that he's played by Christian Marquand, I think.
Lol. Brilliant bit of meta comedy there.
Even the director comes in and goes, right, it's my turn now to lech on this young starlet that I've cast.
Yeah. In a bar by saving from gangsters for no reason. And then he just films her in the bathroom and knocks the plumbing so that she gets wet. And he just gets really close and films her and breaks things in the bathroom. And you're just going, what is this as a thing? Like, what is going on? I really got lost at this point because I did not know what there were no rules anymore. Like there was the narrative was driven by the family and the injured dad. And then it was like, I don't care about that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, just, it was making some kind of sense up to the hospital. And then it went off, some sort of deep end and just, it never comes back.
It never ties it all back together really.
Like, it brings characters back, but in a way that makes even less sense.
Do we have a Hunchback at some point?
Oh,
is this next?
Yeah.
Is this one of the next encounters? Is a odd Hunchback?
She gets out of there and she's wet, and this Hunchback finds her and off. keeps saying "rubber dub dub"
because who knows why?
And it's because she's apparently stupid and just implicitly trusts everyone, even at this point, after everything that's happened to her.
This is something I want to talk about. As a character, I found her sympathetic because she goes through a horrible, surreal farce. But she's quite... I mean, she's not that ditzy. She's just... She experiences the film and the people around her. She isn't that stupid. Like, she seems to be sensible enough. She just can't deal with it. She's always the one... being reasonable in a surreal world.
Yeah.
And she isn't thick and ditzy, and she doesn't put out, she's always put upon. Like, she's a victim, and I just kind of feel like, as a strong female character, I mean, she's not a strong female, do you know what I mean? Like, she's a good character, and
she's somewhere approaching a sympathetic... I hesitate to say relatable.
But she's not an idiot. She's not like a vacuous, ditzy blonde. She's just...
Yeah.
The longer it goes on,
the more you're going, why are you still accepting this?
Yeah, why are you so along for this ride?
Why are you so calm about this? She's reasonable to the point of insanity. Because she's kind of... as people latch on her, she just questions them and go, this isn't right. And it's like,
yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do this. But then she doesn't seem psychologically scarred, which she should be. She copes with it fairly well. I think she, by the end of the film, reaches enlightenment to some extent, if that's what I was trying to say was happening. I mean, I don't know how trusted the Marlon Brando guru character was.
But the Hunchback. This is where it turned from odd to outright just weird. Because he can climb the walls.
Like Hunchbacks always do.
And along the ceiling. And then the police turn up for some reason. Because some teenagers come in and raid his house and throw panties everywhere.
But they also... like have some, there's some kind of criminals that are unveiling things in this mansion or something they're in.
Yeah,
they're outside and they're in a mansion. I couldn't even understand what was happening blow by blow. Like, not a jot. And then there was just, you know, brutal policemen, as you say.
I did laugh, though, when she first gets to his mansion and he's got all these, he's got that piano. And
they sort of climb into it, don't they?
She says, play me something, and he just kind of smashes the piano and then...
Yeah, I don't know what... Is he in an allegory for anything? That's something to ask of all these characters. Do they mean anything? I wouldn't give it the time of day to analyse it, really, but...
That was... like the climbing the walls and jumping through the mirror that turned to liquid was from story.
It looked really... like, he's got a green mirror that the Hunchback jumps into it, and it gets properly weird. At times, it was just weird sketches that got out of control. And then other times, he was like, this is the weirdest.
I watched it, and he, like, climbed the wall and then jumped through that water mirror. And I thought, wow, that would have been really cool if the film had in any way earned that.
Yeah. That's what I mean. They keep doing things just often enough for you to go... that was a little bit of good I just saw. Just a little flint of good.
Yeah.
Maybe try something by Frank Elmbaum. Do an adaptation of Wizard of Oz, or maybe do Alice in Wonderland. Because you have this psychedelic style down. You have great music coming in. Maybe don't stunt cast it. But although that could have been the reason it got a few people in to get the box office up is, ooh, and then people talked about it and probably had similar conversations of what was that about? You've got to see this weird film I saw the other day. Like, so, I don't know. Maybe if it had a better story, it could have been something interesting, at least visually.
Once the Hunchback's gone, the police take her.
Yeah,
but they take her to, like, a house full of drag queens or something,
and it's all screaming. I could barely watch this, but it was just screaming noises. I couldn't even understand. And again, this whole section, I don't know. I'm not even sure what to explain it as, because I don't really know that they clarified.
No, they didn't. It was just a bunch of drag queens running around screaming, fighting these two police. And the noise of the film at this point was like when someone's using a drill in the same room as you and you're trying to concentrate on something.
Only you're meant to concentrate on the drill noise. Yeah. So this film was distracting you. Abby, what's the scene we get into off the back of this?
Somehow. I thought you were just going to ask her what's happening.
What's happening, Abby? Abby, what's happening?
On? There is a... Just before we go away from this bit, I want to talk about, again, another sliver of something good. In this bit was where there was police brutality against a drag queen, but the drag queen sort of encouraged him to keep going.
Yeah.
And the way he reacted and sort of went, dodge! Yeah. I don't know what to do in this situation. That was a little glint again.
Yeah. Oh, it's some actual humour.
Yeah, you can probably, you know, you could have probably had a few more jokes in there, but whatever.
Yeah.
So, have we got onto Brando now? She has opportunity to get into a big truck that a guru is sitting levitating in, or seemingly levitating.
Yeah, I think
say that, like, if there is a point where this film is consistently watchable for more than about 5 minutes, it's probably this scene-ish.
Yeah.
I think Richard Burton, I found intriguing on screen, and I found, you know, Brando's stuff. He wasn't as offensive as I thought he'd be.
No,
he certainly wasn't appropriate, but he was an interesting performance because it was so departed from everything Brando's known for. And both young Brando and old Brando were nowhere to be seen here. It was a very different kind of behaviour.
And it was interesting in the same way Richard Burton was, in that in this film they both seem perfectly happy to just make fools of themselves.
Yeah.
Like, they just go, this is ridiculous, and just go with it. And, that, like, in the spirit of that, it's that their performances are kind of fun to watch.
This is the reason I wanted to share. It's not just I thought it was torture and I had to share it. I genuinely thought there was some talking points, and it was Richard Burton's need of just being in a glass-bottom limousine. Just, what is going on? And then also Brando, this long-haired, like, I guess he's a charlatan guru? Cause, I mean, he might be a white bloke faking it.
I think that's, like, hinted at a couple of times. Because every now and again, like, not in an actor screwing up in, like, real life, but in a, like, in the film, he slips in bits of American accent.
Yeah, and I think his wig moves and he doesn't seem to mind. And he's like, yeah, whatever. Like, I think it's deliberately meant to be that way, yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than, oh, isn't this terrible? They don't even care. Like, because when Ringo Starr wasn't being a fake Mexican, he was being a terrible, terrible character that made no sense. Whereas this was deliberately, like, a man who goes around in a truck pretending to be a guru. Fantastic interior, where there's, like, shells and stuff glued to the walls, and it's kind of this amazing interior of the van.
I'm not 100%, but I think he was the magician in the place where the drag queens were.
Was he? Baby.
Was he?
It's possible.
Like many things in this film, it's possible.
Yeah. Terry Gilliam could have nailed her to a frisbee and thrown her into one of his films just as easily. Like, if at times it kind of felt a bit Terry Gilliam-y. Only without... he could have added some satire that would have genuinely been there.
Yeah, but it did have the same... Oh, this is annoying. A lot of Terry Gilliam films.
Annoying, haphazard, visually interesting, and kind of creepy as well as funny. Yeah. But anyway, like, this Brando thing, he is taking her through the many stages that he seems to be making up of enlightenment. And I don't know why. She's going with it because she's polite and nice. And has forgotten about why she's on this journey.
Much like everyone watching the film.
I remember there's a dad in distress who never gets resolved, who has brain damage and a plug in his head, and it doesn't matter because
it does get resolved.
Does it?
Kind of.
What do they resolve?
Oh, well, we'll come to that at the end.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry for not understanding the film. That was perfectly simple and straightforward.
I wouldn't say it gets resolved. The film certainly throws something at you.
It gets referenced again.
Yes.
Let's put it that way.
But Brando is enigmatic and odd, and he does this weird thing where, again, he goes to that, oh, and eventually this will turn to him trying to force himself on her. But, again, less so. A few of the characters are less horrible when they turn to fancying Candy and their motivation changes to being lustful. Like, his is more sweet and funny, because I think one of the scenes is that underneath a sheet together, and Marlon Brando's talking rubbish about in all these stages, and they keep switching positions. They're all kind of entangled together.
I thought that was pretty funny, because you'd get like a long shot of the bed where they're like shuffling around under the covers, and then it would cut back underneath, and he'd have like his leg wrapped around his own head.
Yeah,
and he'd be like, that was pretty good, and just like in a cartoony kind of way.
And it was odd, because it was Marlon Brando being an Indian guru guy and being kind of funny, and then you should never be pretzeled with Marlon Brando in The Incorrect Race. Gave us that, this film did. It gave us Marlon Brando the pretzel. Just think about that. Anyway, he also had a weird rig on his truck so that he could make it look like a starry sky was appearing, even though they're like flooring it on the motorway during the day, and he kept trying to make these bizarre illusions, like the floating thing. And he's very open about breaking the illusions, and then he starts talking garbage about like how he can easily do illusions, and there's genuine spiritual magic to some of this gobbledygook he's spouting. And
but then it snows or something, and she gets out, and he ends up frozen.
But not that bothered by it. He's buried in snow, and he doesn't seem to mind. It's quite cryptic. Abby, can you remember what happens to get us out of Brando?
There's a lot of weather there before he gets frozen. She gets out, and then she finds the other guru.
The real guru sitting in the desert with like clay all over his face.
Yeah, we just get a weird man who doesn't really have a character. He just sort of leads her.
Well, no.
No, but
here you go. He leads her into some kind of weird temple, like Buddhist temple, which then collapses around them. And it kind of looks like they're having sex, I guess, like a lot of the scenes in this. But then as the water runs in and washes the clay off his face, and then the hood comes off, he has a plug in the back of his head.
And that's her dad.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. And then she actually screams like daddy, but there's no voice at this point, but you see her mouth it.
I think Freud would have a free field day with this film, wouldn't he?
Well,
there's religious imagery montaged in with this nonsense, the temple. Yeah.
Like every other pretentious idiot, I did a degree that involved film analysis and textual analysis and all that stuff. And I'm pretty good at, digging into a film. I like stuff, I like David Lynch and all that kind of nonsense. But this, at that point, when that happened, I just went, what?
Yeah. It makes a token. You kind of go, it's like someone pretending they know how to do deep, complicated cinema. It's like, religious stuff and father figures and lust.
Yeah.
And it's like, you haven't got any substance to that, have you?
Yeah,
you haven't been doing, you haven't been stringing together or anything.
Yeah. It's like the director going, see? And then you go, see what? And they go,
You didn't make a compelling jigsaw of weirdness. You have done nothing. You've failed your A-level film.
Yeah.
And then it decides its big finish is she's walking through a field with a bunch of banners and all the people she's already met.
Oh, yeah.
And the surgeon
is injecting people and turning them into child versions of themselves, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have.
That's when I got angry.
It just goes full on.
What kind of resolution is this?
Yeah, it goes full on. Yeah, hippies with flags and in a field now. We're having a happy. Remember all the lovable characters who basically tried it on with Candy and were lecherous and horrible.
Yeah.
They're all back, and here they are, being whimsical in a field together. What was that all in aid of? It doesn't matter, she's floating off her spirity orb thing that we had, floats off into space again.
Back to space, where she came from, I guess. Yeah,
or something. There was quite a nice reveal where the guy playing the dad and the stepfather did, he walked past a flag, and then he turns direction, and he's changes. He lights a cigarette and he becomes the other character, and then he reveals that he's wearing half glasses, like, on his face.
I did like that. But like, I like that. But at the same time, I thought if the film had been full of more of that kind of, you know, on the sleeve weirdness, it would have almost benefited just from. It's almost like it. It's too weird, but at the same time, doesn't take the right kind of weirdness far enough.
It's not creative enough. It kind of
It's not imaginative enough.
It needs a bit of Michael Gondry, where you kind of go, okay, we're going to do these kind of cool visuals and illusions, and we're going to kind of show you how it's done, but still baffle you that we went to this effort. Like, Michael Gondry could have had a good go, Terry Gilliam could have had a good go. I don't say that they should have touched anything to do with this plot. Like, but it was that kind of missed opportunity, like, that the film had. And it felt like, oh, let's remember the sketch characters that were all in this fantastic film that we definitely concluded with a point. And let's remember them all. Here they are, and it's a cast call again. Oh.
Yeah. Oh, the core list of lovable rapists that make up this film.
Yeah. Brilliant. They're all back. Yeah, and it's very... And it just has, again, great music playing. Like, throughout the film, it had quite a good soundtrack. I really liked it for that.
It had a good soundtrack, but it did not have good sound design.
Because some of the dubs actual, were pretty bad as well.
Yeah, and just the sound of the film generally, it was like, I thought it was a really like shrill, irritating film.
I think sometimes it was meant to be that. But yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm not saying it was a perfect, like, all the way. Yeah. The sound was, but some of the music was just good because it was the 60s, a time when. You know, it was kind of a revolution in what, you know, music was going to be, and you know, it was a crucible for creativity, music-wise. But yeah, I don't know, guys. You shared the film experience with me, and I'm sorry, but also I couldn't live with it alone. I'd never know what it was about. We still don't know what it's about, do we?
No, it's definitely a shared experience. You can't watch it alone, partly because it makes you feel like a really dirty pervert, even if you don't enjoy any of it.
No.
So you have to, like, watch, like, make other people watch it just to absolve yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like the curse in The Ring.
Okay.
It's like, you have to pass it on before it eats away at you.
Yeah, I think that's what needed to happen. And
you've infected us with it now.
Yeah, yeah.
You've infected us with the need.
The need. The need. We all want candy, both metaphorically and literally.
You will be saying that for a few days, though, Jamie. That is the one thing about this movie that clings with you, is every only... when you get the chance, you will go, need.
I did like his mention of the Welsh language as well.
I was going to say the same thing, yeah. I liked his poem that he was promoting. Or his collection of poems or whatever was also available in Welsh, which is a nice little thing to say, but
we're from such a small country that every time anyone on a, like, a global scale mentions it, we're like, yes,
well done, yay.
Yeah. So I don't know. In terms of, like, final thoughts, I think we've all established it was weird. It's hard to watch, and just makes you feel bad. But as it, like, a rating, I guess we can go for types of candy or something. But, like, final thoughts and rating, that's the time. Time to put this thing out of its misery.
Well, I've said it in sort of nebulous way so far. But the thing about this film for me is I keep thinking, like, I'm the one who's missed something. And that, I look at it and go, you have done parts of this superbly well. The music is good. The physical way in which you have filmed it is at times excellent. There's nothing wrong with the acting per se.
Ringo Starr.
Okay. Yes, he is a black mark. But a lot of the other people who were in it did perfectly fine with what they were given.
Yeah.
And it's just, I kind of feel like, is it me?
Yeah, one of the things to consider is it didn't receive terrible press. Like, it didn't like it didn't get slated by critics as being garbage. It got some praise and stuff.
It makes me feel bad, again, as someone who did, like, a degree in pretentious rubbish. It makes me feel like I'm being an idiot and not seeing something that everyone else is seeing. I'm like, am I thick now? Like, have I lost my knack for challenging films?
We're not. There's no way we're too stupid to understand the nuances of Candy. I think partly people would have gone to see it for the actors, who were suspiciously big for the type of film it was, and the fact that they probably were expecting it to be a bit titillating. It's about a young woman, and it's going to be this slightly overly sexual farce. I think people would have gone to see it for that purpose. Got disappointed that it wasn't more raunchy.
It does have a lot of, like, the hallmarks of, like, 60s, like, new age hippie culture. It just doesn't... I don't think it just says anything. It just has them in there.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it is. It's just properly like a dream, like a bizarre fever dream. Again, like, it's just weird. Wall-to-wall odd. And, like Abby said, there's a few things in there that are kind of gems alone. They kind of stand alone as almost memes of, like, Richard Burton and Marlon Brando and stuff. And even Ringo Starr, it's kind of, you just cap him saying his weird Mexican accent stuff. And that almost is enough. Yeah. Abby, do you have a candy or sweet thing you would to rate it as?
This movie is like a packet of love hearts, which is a sweet that we have in this country. That is sort of it's a powder-based sweet. They've essentially taken a powder, put it into a tablet shape.
Yeah.
With no specific flavour. Just
sweet.
The flavour of colour.
Yeah.
I think those, what are those love heart things? Those, like, round discs with hearts with messages in. Yeah. I think they're quite famous.
And the messages are always, they have nothing to do with each other. And they're apropos of nothing. One might say, love me. The other one might say, kisses. Another one might say, hug. And that's how this film works. It's just a row of love hearts that you're reading one at a time.
Or do they say horrible, atrocious things? Need. Oh, this is no... Yeah, on them it'll say, this is no good. Stuff like that.
Actually, I'm going to add an element. It's love hearts in a tombola. That's how this film was generated.
Yeah, just picking out random love hearts and stringing together whatever nonsense comes out of.
Lol, cute, McGillicuddy. I don't know. It's like one of those. It is like a, like, occasionally the messages will be cute and charming, and other times they'll just be random and annoying, and they don't make a fulfilling meal, certainly, or even dessert.
Yeah, they're not actually nice. Like, love hearts, they're just chalky and.
People get them just for, like, people who don't get enough text messages. They like them for themselves. Like, oh, I can pretend someone loves me, even though I bought myself these sweets. Gosh, I don't know if I have anything else to say about the film. Other than picking a sweet or a candy that I think it is. I guess it's like one of those, like, random bags. Like, you get randoms now, which are, like, various pick-a-mix sweets all in one, like, Rowntree's bag. But it's filled with horrible, sour, sugary ones that taint all of the other bits. Like, I might get a little squidgy ice cream or a little frog that I like, and then there's a horrible, sour cola bottle that's tainted the flavour of all the ones I like, and got sugar on everything, and has spoilt it entirely. And maybe some sherbet has spilled all over it to make it all kind of rancid. So it's a horrible bag of randoms that are just sour and disgusting. And occasionally I can wipe off enough of the horribleness to have a nice one. That's what I would
say. So it's like, this movie could potentially work. If the elements aligned correctly, it could have worked extremely well. But they didn't align at all.
Yeah,
and was consequently terrible.
I had to share my bag of horrible sweets in the hope that some of you guys would eat the bad ones, and I'd be left with a squidgy jelly Brando or a chocolate Richard Burton. But that's what I think.
Jamie?
His his voice is like chocolate.
It's a good voice. And the fan joke is hilarious. The fact that he's constantly being blown by a fan, no matter where he is, and his scarf's kind of wibbling as well. That's like a really good concept for like a pretentious poet thing.
Yeah.
I want to hear him read out more addresses as well.
Yeah.
And his poetry was bad funny. It was like so awful. And the fact that everyone was like applauding him and like young girls were swooning and fainting and kissing the steps he walked on. I thought that was all very good. Yeah. I thought it was just early on.
The poetry was like spot on, pretentious, bad poetry. Unfortunately, the rest of the film became one of his poems.
Yeah. I could see a spin-off film where it was just Richard Burton's, like, what's he called? He's called, like, Mephisto. Which sounds partly innuendo-y, but also like a He-Man character as well.
Yeah.
Mephisto, the poet, would make a good kind of one, like the life and poems of Mephisto, and it's like this odd origin story of him. I think that'd be a good film, maybe. Or not.
Good.
Jimmy, what were you saying?
Oh. I don't know what, like, I think Abby's Love Hearts comparison, actually, and the randoms, I guess it's just like a bag of pick and mix. Even when I was a kid, I didn't really the only sweets I like now are chocolate, or maybe chocolate with like biscuit or wafer in it. I can't do like gummy sweets or anything like that. They gross me out and give me a headache. Mm. But when I was a kid, because you're a kid, you think you like all sweets.
Yeah, you basically OD on them as well. And horrible, painful teeth and feel a bit sick.
So, like any other kid, I would go to Woolworths to the pick and mix and get like the scoop and fill up the bag with all kinds of different colourful things. Mm. And then I'd go to eat them and they'd just be, I would just be eating them just thinking, this is all just horrible. And that's kind of what happened here. It's all this like colour and noise and the whole time I'm just sitting there going, ugh. Mm.
Like actual candy, it is actually bad for you.
This
candy, that's it. It's bad for you, and this candy doesn't even taste good. Should have bought a chocolate bar. More conventional and tasty.
Much like eating a bag of pick and mix, I came away from this feeling sick and with a headache.
Yeah, that's true. I think that says it all for candy. It hasn't honoured my dog very well. She was very sweet and nice. But,
I presume that dog's dead now, or did she go back into space?
An orb came down and took her away, and she's finished her narrative with me when I was a kid. Yeah. So, that's maybe next time something more straightforward. But we've experienced psychedelia without having to take acid or travel back in time. I feel like we've done it the safe way, where we can close our web browsers or eject our DVDs and fling them over a rainbow. that's it. Podcast over, guys. Time to say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.